Hi, this is David LeBlanc interviewing Rodney Brooks for Shy Robotics.
Good evening, Dr. Brooks. I'd like to first off thank you for granting me the opportunity to ask you a few questions. You will have my deepest respect. I've read so many articles related to your work that I think it's safe to assume that, in my opinion, you are one of the fathers of service robots. With all due respect, I prepared a list of questions to further discover more about your passion and vision for robotics. Specifically, I'm incredibly interested in the way you see the future of robotics through your company, along with others.
My first question is about cobotics. What do you think of cobotics? What is it for you?
Well, I use the word collaborative robot rather than, but we've seen some great examples of collaborative robots. I like one of my favorite examples was the Kiva Systems that Amazon bought, which was a company in Boston, where I don't know if you know these robots. It's for fulfillment. All the new Amazon fulfillment centers now have these robots in them. And, you know, it's easy, K-I-V-A, K-I-V-A systems, if you'll find videos of them. So here's the thing. In an existing Amazon fulfillment center, people, you know, either on bicycles or they run along shelf to shelf and they grab stuff. And then they come back and then other people pack it. But the people are doing two things. They're running in straight lines and they're picking out of a shelf. Robots are actually pretty good at going in straight lines. They're not good at picking. So what the Kiva system does is the robots go under the shelves and bring the shelves to the person. So the person stands still and shelf comes, they pick. Shelf comes, they pick. A light goes on the shelf. And so now they're doing picking, but they're not running to find things. So it was a great collaboration between robots. It's easy, relatively, to make robots move in straight lines. It's very hard to make robots pick out of a bin. So let the people do the picking, but let the robots move the material. And the thing I liked most was it switched the idea of keeping the shelves still and the robot going to the shelf or the person going to the shelf. Instead, the shelves come to the person with an orange robot underneath. So all the new Amazon fulfillment centers are being built with these robots in them. So I think we're going to see for a long time, certainly during my lifetime, most likely for all of your lifetime, it's going to be a collaboration between people and robots, because I don't think robots are going to be able to do everything within 50 years or 100 years. I think it's going to be a long process before robots can do anything. So the key will be to find ways for robots and people to work together and partition the work into what we can do with robots, and then have the people do the more cognitive things for the foreseeable future.
When you look at your experience and studies, you can see how well you master your subject. Is this scientists and engineering culture from your family or your friends?
No. My parents didn't finish high school. My grandfather was a butcher. I used to watch him cutting meat. There's no one else in my family. I'm weird.
What did motivate you?
Well, I won the genetic lottery because, you know, neither of my parents had finished high school. They didn't know anyone who'd gone to university. They certainly didn't know any academics. But by the time I was age four, everyone called me the professor because I just came out being a professor. I could do arithmetic in my head that they couldn't do even on paper at age four. It was weird. Just weird. There isn't it's an anomaly. It's no explanation.
We can see some pieces implemented into Baxter that are can link to your past publication.
Oh, yeah. But not as intense as in the research lab, because in research lab you push things very far. In product, it has to actually work every time in the real world. In the research lab, there's a team of students. Each time they try it, the team makes it happen. With a product, you put it in a box and never see it again, and it better work. So it has to be simpler. It's more robust. It has to be robust.
How did you put this technology out of the university, and how did you decide to build Rethink Robotics?
Well, the original thing that led to Rethink Robotics was because of my experience at iRobot, because iRobot did and still does manufacture the Roomba in China.
Mm-hmm.
So I had first set up some manufacturing for some earlier products in China in 1997. So I spent a lot of time in China. And also in my role at MIT, we worked with a lot of Taiwan-based companies who were OEMs who were trying to become more product design companies. And so I also had many colleagues and friends who were Chinese manufacturers. And what I saw was that labor costs were going up and that the era of limitless cheap labor would come to an end. And it has in just the last two or three years, really, as we see the number of 19-year-olds decreasing rapidly in China. The biggest problem for manufacturing in China is recruiting and retention of workers. So it seemed to me, from my experience at iRobot and also experience at MIT, listening to the people who owned those companies, that the era of limitless labor was not going to last forever in China. So you're not going to get limitless labor in Europe or in the US, but maybe with robots you can make people more productive. And by the way, in the US, I believe the average age of a factory worker is 56 years old. People don't want those jobs. You know, when sometimes I'm giving a talk and, you know, people get angry at me and they say, but your robots will take away jobs. And I don't believe they'll take away jobs. But secondly, I say, do you want your children? Are you going to get them to work in factories when they grow up? And they say, no, of course not. Well, whose children do you want to work in factories? Whose children, you know, are worthy of working in factories if your children are too important to work in factories? People don't, you know, just like people don't, you know, dig with their hands in the soil anymore. We have machines.
And this is one of the principles of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
That's why we are speaking about the new Industrial Revolution.
So
how did robotics started in your life?
In my life? Well, really, because I was this weird child, my mother would look for books for me. And when I was seven, she gave me two American books. I still have them. They were a series of books, How and Why Wonder books. Later I saw the series in the school library. But she gave me two, one on electricity and one on computers and giant brains. And so the one on electricity showed how to make basic circuits. And the one on computers and giant brains had the binary system, had drawings of robots in it. And so I wanted to build computers. I used the electricity book to figure out how to build the circuits to build computers. They were very simple, you know, 7, 8 years old. But over time, they got more complex.
Okay.
And I wanted to build robots, but robots is so mechanical, I just wasn't good enough at it. My first robot, I think I was 16 before I finally built an actual robot, because it's just too hard to get the motors aligned and all that sort of stuff.
Okay. And so today you are more in business than in technical stuff, so...
Yeah, I don't do anything directly in the product, but I do prototypes that I show the engineers. You know, what if we do it this way? So I still write code, but the code doesn't. There is some of my code in there, but no new code. I just do prototypes, demonstrations. We could do it this way, and I put together, you know, something. And I was programming in my hotel room before I came.
Really?
Yeah.
Which language?
Lisp, of course.
Yeah, this is adapted to the artificial intelligence.
Yeah, well, it's sort of funny. I'm just, it's my, it's you know, what I grew up with. So. You know, we stay what we started with. But recently I learned JavaScript, so.
I think we almost replied to this question regarding some of your publication. I've seen that your work often focuses on improving the principle you described in your publication, a robust layer control system for a mobile robot. And I've seen another publication
Which is the very first time I presented that work was in France, actually.
in Paris,
No, just north of Paris.
Lyon,
What's the name
Lyon.
of the village? There's a lace named after the village. Nearby is Abbey Royamont. Chantilly?
Chantilly.
Yes, that's where the very first time I presented. There was a
Okay.
conference there.
So the principle is to change the way, finally, it was automatons worked and transform it to robots with different tasks,
Yeah, so the idea
styles.
is to have layers which are just running all the time. And Baxter has them. So Baxter's arms can never collide. You know, when you grab Baxter's arm, you can move it. You can move both of them, but you can't move them to the same place. It won't let that happen. So that's a low-level layer. So when you're doing something high level with Baxter, you don't have to worry about the arms colliding because the low-level behaviors make it impossible and impossible for it to hit its head. So you don't have to worry
Okay.
about that.
So since this publication, you introduced the principle of priorities,
Yeah,
the
and
low
the
level that
yeah, they can be
controls this.
overridden sometimes, but basically those low levels run autonomously, independently.
Is that
And that's really very directly how the Roomba is programmed.
I was thinking about the safety of the system for the human. How did you manage it with a product that don't really know what will happen because of
Well,
those several tasks?
so there's one layer that runs there that it's every time it moves, it's predicting what forces it will feel, and it senses the force on every joint. So you can, with a Jacobian, you can resolve what force is on the arm. So
Okay.
whenever there's some unexpected force, it stops right away. Now, it's not a really strong robot in the first place, and it doesn't have a high mass. So yesterday I was demonstrating the robot to someone, so I just put my head in the way and it hit my head and I'm
Okay.
still okay. So this strategy, you know, if the robot had a payload of 100 kilograms, the strategy would not work. But the strategy that we have of the robot not being really strong and predicting what the forces are and stopping whenever the forces are different is sufficient for it to be safe. So
I've seen another publication about the path that the robot uses to move. You know that there is I don't know if I noticed this one. This is
one
with
of my publications.
this was with a robot in a subdivision
Oh,
algorithm in configuration
that's
space.
30, 33, 32 years ago.
Yeah, you don't.
No, that was an early paper, and then lots of other people worked on that. And it's common software now. I mean, Jean-Paul Lemond at Toulouse. Jean-Claude Latombe, who was at Grenoble and then ran Stanford's robotics lab, very famous guy for doing that. People at NYU, people at MIT, Tomás Lozano Pérez, so many people have worked on it since
Okay.
then. Jacob Schwartz was a very big name at NYU for a while. So I just did an early paper
Okay.
did something else. So all the software that does that now is developed by other people, and it's libraries and it's common.
And this is not linked to the way Baxter moves.
Baxter uses some of those libraries, but they're libraries that are standard.
I've read that you introduced neurobiology, ethology, psychology, and sociology in your Baxter project. Can you tell me
Well,
more?
in Baxter, certainly all those things at MIT were there. At At Rethink Robotics, we don't have all of those disciplines. We certainly have user experience. Mm-hmm. It's been important, and understanding people. We have people with art backgrounds in both the industrial design and in the user interface design. So the aesthetic is very important. So, you know, you see on Baxter, it's got these eyes. It's important, I believe. Well, whenever you have a product, its appearance is making a promise of how it will be. And you better deliver on that promise, or otherwise people will be confused or angry. So I say that if you build a robot that looks like Albert Einstein, it should be as smart as Albert Einstein. So we were very careful not to make Baxter look too smart, because Baxter isn't very smart. So we tried to find a thing which made it look reliable, because it's reliable. It has some awareness of the world, but it's not a genius. It's not as smart as a person. It doesn't look like a person. It's clearly not a person. It's not, you know, whereas some of the Japanese robots try to look just like people. So we used people, you know, with an appreciation of users to help with that design, to try to get the right level. And that's also one thing people say, why is it a he? And I say it's not a he, it's an it. Because if it was a he or a she, it would be making a promise about gender in some way. And I don't know what promise a robot could make about that. So I call it an it.
This is in the naval. They speak about she, and they speak about their boats.
And yeah.
You didn't...
No, it's an it.
You used ROS?
Yeah, we used ROS. Yeah.
And did you implement more functionalities?
Oh, yeah. And it's interesting. We're just reevaluating. You know, some things just were not in ROS at the time, and we built our own systems, and now, you know, lots of people have been working on some of those things. There are alternatives now in ROS, so we have to evaluate. Should we keep our own? Should we adopt the community ones? So we're looking at that.
So all the code of Baxter is open source?
No. But over the next year, it will be open APIs to all of it.
Do you know the makers community?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Their point of view about that is more sharing everything they do and explaining everything. What do you think about this community?
Well, that works for some things. You know, it's hard to have a, when you're in a competitive business where there are other players who don't do that, it's sometimes hard to do that. We sell the, you know, generation, you know, sells the research version of the robot, which is the same physical robot, has a slightly different and very open software on it. Okay. It will, over the next year, that will also have all the manufacturing software integrated. But, so that's a very open platform for the research side. We're very open with that.
And do you think that the makers can work only for a reasonable area because of this sharing of things?
Well, you know, I think, take for instance, imagine... passenger jet airplanes. Can you imagine them being done by the maker community? I think there's some things that makers can be good at. Now, a lot of our customers in factories use 3D printers, low-cost 3D printers, to print special fingers. And we public, you know, we have an interface. We're going to have a new interface for hands. We're encouraging people to build hands interchangeable. And so at that level, we're promoting it.
What do you think of neural networks?
They've been around a long time. And mostly they're not very neural. They're networks. You know, they're inspired by biology and they, you know, there's some good work there. But I think it's a little of an exaggeration to think that they're really accurate models of actual neurons. So they're inspired by some connectivity properties of neurons. But really the most successful algorithms backpropagation. That doesn't happen in the brain.
Have you been able to compare the work between the beginning of neural networks and today? Because I think that there is a huge the work stopped around 1945. I don't know if you've seen some work from this.
McCulloch Pitts. And they were actually inspired, if you read their first papers, they were inspired by the analogy between logic gates and neurons. So this was a funny modeling.
Okay.
Then out of that came in the 50s and 60s a change of weight method, which had independently come from statistics. And then in the late 60s, the perceptron came, and then Minsky and Papert wrote a book debunking perceptrons, saying they couldn't do lots of things. But I think they were unfair because they sort of set up, well, if you make these restrictions, you can't do all these things with neural nets. But those restrictions were too restricted, so it was sort of an academic, sleight of hand. And then in the 70s and 80s with Ramelhart, etc., the things got much more general. And still today, I think, based on those ideas, there's lots of, machine learning is based on those ideas. Then there's another group out there trying to build hardware neurons, and
doesn't work well.
I will be surprised.
Okay,
I'll be surprised. I think sometimes the claims that are made, the generalization of the claims, is a little too strong.
About the jobs,
sure.
This is a big arguing. Many people think that the robots and technology are taking jobs, but
we certainly have. I'm afraid we're not going to have enough robots. I really am. I think in Europe, in China, in North America, we will need. And I'm going to talk in my talk tomorrow about this. We will need robots to look after the elderly because this is demographic inversion, and. I look at my mother in Australia. She's in a managed care facility, and she can't walk anymore. And she needs people to help her wash, to get dressed, to go to the toilet, to get into bed, to get out of bed. Who are those people? They're only brand new immigrants. And they do the job for 2 or 3 months, and then they get a better job. Because it's not a great job, helping old people go to the bathroom. So, there's no dignity for my mother having to have people, especially that they're just immigrants who often don't speak English in Australia. And, and I'm not saying anything's wrong with those people. It's just, she wouldn't have dignity if I was helping her go to the toilet. She would be so embarrassed, if I was helping her go to the toilet. So I see a role for machines to help people, which lets the elderly have dignity because they have control over their life. My mother can't go to bed when she chooses. She can only go to bed when the aides arrive to put her in bed. She has no choice. She has no control. So I think as I get older, I want control over my life. And having machines to help me, robots, will be important, I think. And no one wants those jobs because the immigrants come to Australia and after 2 or 3 months, they get a better job. They're horrible jobs. So I don't see it as taking away jobs that people want.
Do you think you can generalize this relationship between robots and humans? Because I've read a study recently that explained that the patients that were helped by human nurses were good nurses, were in a better...
I'm not saying that don't have nurses. I'm saying for these, I'm saying for these bodily functions, let people have their dignity. And I'm not saying those robots are going to be companions. Not at all. In Japan, they talk about robot companions. They're not companions. They're machines. I love my dishwashing machine. but I don't think of it as a companion.
Okay. Yeah,
And when I was a kid, we didn't have a dishwashing machine, so my father would wash and I would dry. And that was a social interaction, I admit, but and that's gone from my life, but it's okay.
industrial robots were very expensive for bakery or the butcher or
Well,
your
worse
robots.
than that, worse than that. Very hard to integrate because industrial robots, first industrial robots were installed in 1961 when a computer in 1961 would fill this room. So they didn't have computers. So they followed a series of steps repeatedly without, and sensors were expensive, cameras were $50,000, $100,000. So they didn't, and then no computation to look at the cameras. So industrial robots started out blind and dumb and then largely stayed that way. And it's up to systems integrators to connect sensors to them to write software. It's sort of like when you buy an industrial robot, it's sort of like you get this, it'd be like buying a phone where it comes without the cameras installed, without the microphone installed, and no software. Now it's up to the customer to get the software from somewhere, get the sensors from somewhere, and put them together. So the cost of using a robot in a bakery or somewhere else, the cost of the actual robot is actually only one fifth or one tenth of the overall price. But then it has to do the same thing again and again, and not a very dynamic environment. So I say that Baxter is not an industrial robot. It's a different category because it comes fully integrated with sensors and software, and out of the box, you show it the task and it does the task and it adapts in real time. So it's got some simple common sense. Not very smart. So I see it as a very different model. So most of our customers who buy the robot for factories or logistics centers have no robots there at all, because it just hasn't been practical to put the robots. Our smallest customer for a manufacturing robot in the US is a nine-person company in Tennessee. So they didn't have any automation, but they bought Baxter, tens of plastic molding machines.
Do you think you will influence the world of industrial robotics?
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we,
I hope to upend
yeah.
it.
And since the 1990s, there is a new model. Before that, we were one to many, and today we're in a one to one business, which made the all those tools to take information from people and being able to focus on profiles and those robots could be specialized in how can I say that? They can do one task several times and they can also do one task and after that do another one
Yeah,
and
right. So they're sort of serially monogamous.
Yeah.
I never thought of that phrase before for this, but they do one thing for a while, then they do a different thing for a while. See, I like that. Serially monogamous.
So, finally, the
I think my marketing people will hate
finally, the way you use your robots can really influence the industrial robots, and you could finally replace them
Well, yeah, I
for
mean,
the
I
long
not well,
term.
not directly, but it's a bit like, I sort of think that today's industrial robots are more like mainframes of the past. And then when the first PCs came out, they were no, it was still mainframes, and PCs were a small, little, tiny niche market. But eventually, they became the dominant market. But that takes a long time. It doesn't happen overnight. I think when you look back, I can't imagine anyone wanting a current industrial robot 50 years from now. What do you mean it's dumb? Robots should be smart, you know. We don't go back and wish for those desktop telephones. Oh, I wish I had a dumb phone again, right? They're gone. They're gone. They're gone forever. You know, they've been replaced by smartphones.
How is your company organized? The structure of your company?
Oh, well, fairly traditionally, in a sense, we have an engineering team, we have a manufacturing team. We don't manufacture the robot itself. We have a manufacturing team which contracts with subcontractors to build components and manage the supply chain. And then we have marketing and we have sales. A little human resources. So it's very conventional.
And for the parts that invent the robots, that design it and design...
Well, there's a tension, a good tension, between marketing and engineering. So actually, first I should say, everyone in the company goes to factories, sees factories. Everyone does that. But, some of the marketing team, the product management team, they go out into factories and really interview people, ask questions, really look at the applications. They go with tape measures, they measure things, they weigh things, they look at the lighting, and they come back with, these are the problems people are facing. Now, if you ask the people in the factory what they want, they'll tell you something which we're not going to build. And maybe it's not. So the key is to find out what they need, what their real pain is, mm-hmm. and then have the engineering team invent something that fits what they need, because mostly people only ask for what they've already seen or what they already know. So,
yeah.
And this is a different sort of product, so we have to lead them. But we have to lead them not with, oh, look, this is a wowee fabulous thing, you'll like it. We have to understand what their problems are, what their pain points are, and then solve those for them.
What did you learn from iRobot that helped you to...
I learned a lot. So yeah. let me tell you something. I'll talk about two areas. User interface and cost. And let's talk about user interface first. What I learned, both on the... at iRobot, we had many, many businesses which failed. But the ones that succeeded were the Roombas, the floor cleaning, and then the robots for roadside bombs in Iraq and Afghanistan. And by the way, iRobot, have some of those robots in Fukushima, in the radiation. Mm-hmm. So I learned about user interface. So the very first Roomba that came out had three buttons on it, S, M, and L. Well, there was a manual which explained that, but no one looks at the manual. So the first confusion was, what is S, M, and L? And it meant small room, medium room, or large room. Is this a large room or a medium room? To the engineers in the company, S, M, L, that makes sense. But to customers, what does that mean? And then we had on the side was a rocker switch with a 1 and 0 on it, the mm-hmm. on and off. We got which way's on, which way's off? What is this switch with 1 and 0? What does that mean? So now if you look at a Roomba, there's one button in the middle that's green that says clean. That's it, clean. Now there are some other little buttons that you can go and do other things if you read the manual and want to. But for normal function, clean. That's it. Because people don't want to be bothered. It's not a high value job cleaning the floor. So, I've got to engineer it, I've got to think about the size. On the military robots, we had a competitor also in Massachusetts. It was originally called Foster Miller, then it got bought by a British company called Kinetic, Q-I-N-E-T-I-Q, which is a British aerospace. And about half the robots in Iraq and Afghanistan were ours, and half were from them. But we were so superior. Our robot was all digital, Ethernet. Their robot was old and analog. And, And then word started coming back that the soldiers in the field preferred their robot than our robot. And why? Well, because the user interface was easier. So the guy who had designed our robot interface said, well, we need smarter users. No, that wasn't going to happen. These are 19-year-old kids. They have a high school diploma, and they've got bullets going past, and they're trying to defuse a bomb on the side of the road. So what we ended up doing was thinking about who the user is. They're 19-year-old kids, just come out of high school. What have they spent their life on? They've been playing games. So we built a ruggedized game controller and put that on the robot. Now, our engineer said, oh, but you can't do everything with this. You can't do such and such. You can't do such and such. Well, with the old controller, it was so hard to use. Even after 2 months of training, most of the soldiers couldn't do those things anyway. Here, with 5 minutes of experimentation, they got to the same level as the old controller instead of 2 months of training. Mm-hmm. So match, in both cases, match the user. On this phone, there's Unix under there. You could make a phone call by going in and typing a command line, a Unix command line, but you may well know Unix. I do. I could do it, but it doesn't make it very useful. That's one thing. The other thing I learned was the power of disruption by price. Because the Roomba was not the first robot vacuum cleaner on the market. Electrolux had one. This is in 2002. It was 2,000 euros in 2002. We came out on September 18th, 2002 with $200. Immediately. Electrolux tried to sue us, said stop. We've been very careful not to infringe on any of that. But we ruined their market. They still haven't come to the US because 2,000 euros compared to $200. Now, how do we get to $200? How come we were so much smarter that we could make such a cheap robot? It wasn't because we were able to make the same robot at that price. It was because we went to people ahead of time and said, how much are you allowed to spend without checking with your wife or husband? And the answer was $200 for our demographic. So that's what we chose first. That was the first piece of the design. It sells in the store for $200. Now, back out of there, what the cost to build it is, then you get how much you can spend on parts. And that's what we built, because that was the target. And it totally disrupted the market by coming out of that price. We chose the price first. So there were two things I learned.
This is how we build a business plan.
Yeah. How do we make it easy to use? Who are the users who have it? And how do we make it something that is functional but is price disruptive?
What is your vision of
long
robotics?
You have to make that into three sentences in your article. Sorry.
What is your vision of robotics over the next 50 years?
I think there will be a lot of elder care. In fact, in my talk tomorrow, are you coming to my talk?
Yeah.
Okay, you're not allowed to answer this question when I ask the question. I'm going to tell you the answer. In my talk, I'm going to put up a picture of a 2014 S-Class Mercedes. I'm going to say, what is this? And some people in the audience will say it's a car, some will say it's a Mercedes, some will say it's an S-Class Mercedes. I say, no, it's an elder care robot. It lets people drive by themselves longer because it's got all these safety systems. Because essentially, the S-Class Mercedes is got a lot of aspects of self-driving cars. It's not totally self-driving, but it can do a lot of it, and that makes it safer. So I think across all aspects of life, catering to the elderly is going to be important. And even factory work is catering to the elderly, because in the US the average age of a factory worker is 56. So it's only elderly people who are working in factories.
Okay.
So I think it's going to be, doing those in collaboration with people around, but infiltrating our lives in many ways. As the Mercedes, BMWs and the high end cars are becoming robotic, and that will go all the way down to Kias in the next 20 years. Every car will have all those systems. Just like with ABS. ABS started out in Mercedes. Yeah. Now every car has ABS.
Do you consider the robots as a member of Internet of Things?
I think more and more so that's going to be true. Yes. And with that, by the way, comes some security issues. As we know, the internet is sort of a poison sea out there. So, yeah.
And, what do you think about the connectivity between robots, between themselves and between the rest of the world and the internet?
I think that's going to come more and more. You know, currently Baxter, by the way, the way you download new software is you on your PC, you download it to a thumb drive and then you go put it into the robot. The current version of Baxter doesn't have any network connectivity. So why not? Well, we went out and talked to the small factories in the US. They don't have network on the factory floor. So we didn't want to say, first get the network, then buy our robot. Right? So we had to make it so it just would operate with no network. But over time, that's changing. And the big companies, of course, the big companies have network connectivity. So that will change fairly soon.
Finish the questions.
Okay.
So thank you very much.
Well, thank you.